morning to you, sir, and your name is?
Daniel Wasson, Your Honor.
Mr. Wasson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I believe this case is a case of first impression. I'll say that with the caveat that this case appears to have been decided by this court under the State Tort Claims Act under Collins v. State. Now, we're here on a political subdivision Tort Claims Act case, but if you've read the briefs, the language between both the State Tort Claims Act and the political subdivision Tort Claims Act is the exact same. Now, I'll take you through the brief facts.
What about the decision in Ragland? Is this really a case of first impression?
I believe so, Your Honor. So tell me
why Ragland doesn't decide it.
Well, first and foremost, I don't think that Ragland ever reached the issue in the case at bar, which is that under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act, you have several hoops that you have to jump through if you're a claimant. The first is to file timely notice within the first year of the date of the accident. So June 30th of 2016 would have been the time that we had to file notice, and in on July 17th of 2015, we did file that notice. In Ragland, there was a whole host of issues. First and foremost, it was never clear that adequate notice was ever provided to the governing body, and it was never clear that a final determination was sent by the governing body to the claimant. Now, as far as Ragland goes, you know, they don't address the situation as in the case at bar, which we have jumped through all the hoops, which we did file timely notice, and then once we received a final determination from the governing body, we filed within the 6 months that were afforded to us under Section 13-919. The injury occurred on June 30th, as I said, 2015. Notice was given July 17th, 2015. A demand was sent to the governing body on June 28th of 2016. And a revised demand was sent April of 2017. And then a denial of that claim was sent on September 13th, 2017. And then we filed suit on November 3rd of 2017, well within the 6 months that are provided to us under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act. Now, there is substantial interplay between the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act and the State Tort Claims Act. This court has held in Collins, it addressed the case of Ragland, and in Coleman v. State, I believe, it also addressed Ragland, even though Coleman v. State was a State Tort Claims Act case and Ragland was a Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act case. So I think this court has recognized that the language is substantially similar in both acts.
I think opposing counsel will argue that there's a real basic reason why cases appear to have gone two different ways. Can you respond to that?
You know, I think there are several good reasons to uphold Collins and overrule Ragland to the extent that it's necessary in this case. First is judicial efficiency. The idea that we're requiring a defendant or, you know, potential tortfeasor to put their final determination out there, and then everyone puts their cards out on the table, and then we can decide whether litigation is actually necessary. And furthermore, judicial efficiency says that if we're looking at it, why file suit and poison the well and increase the other party's exposure by having them incur litigation costs if good faith negotiations are happening?
But in your situation, that case, that claim just sits out there forever. The 2 years has passed. There's not been a withdrawal of the claim. It just sits out there until the political subdivision denies the claim or makes it
That's certainly a possibility, Your Honor. And I think to that extent, and Collins should be addressed there, is that Collins says that once a claimant decides that they're not going to withdraw their claim, it's out of their hands. Then it's entirely in the potential tortfeasor's hands to provide a final determination or not, to say where they stand on the claim. Now, it's possible that, yes, it could go on forever and ever, but it certainly wouldn't be in the potential tortfeasor's interest to do so. I mean, I would assume that you would want to limit your exposure and just flat out deny it, but it is a possibility there.
Well, if you don't deny it, as the political subdivision, there's no recourse by the claimant, is there?
It sits
out there forever. The claimant has no resource whatsoever to render a decision or file a suit, do they?
No, and you know, that's one of the perils of not withdrawing. But, you know, I think that's one of the perils of it. And I think you, depending on how you're getting along with council and how the negotiations are proceeding, you know, I don't see any reason, any policy reason to not let that happen. And additionally, the language in Collins, or the language in both statutes, Collins says that this language is plain and clear. I don't see how you can say that exact same language. It just seems untenable for the court to say that that exact same language in a different statute has an exactly opposite meaning.
Collins talks about, in its last paragraph, it says, we hold that a claimant who files a tort claim with the risk manager of the state claims board 18 months or more after his or her claim is accrued, but within 2 years as provided by 81-8227 sub 1, has 6 months. Isn't the holding of Collins limited to that situation where it's the claim filed 18 months or more, and but within 2 years? And how does any of that play into a political subdivisions case where the deadlines are different?
So, you know, I think the deadlines, there's just an additional hurdle for the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act, which means within the first year you have to file timely notice. So you have 1 year in the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act to put the potential tortfeasor on notice.
But doesn't that preclude the third quarter claims that Justice Papik is talking about?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
The third quarter claims, the fourth quarter claims, when you're filed after 18 months, and you don't have time to withdraw the claim and file suit within the 2 years. For the State Tort Claims Act, and the political subdivision doesn't have that same situation, does it?
No, I don't. I think that the statutes are probably a little more similar. My interpretation of the statutes is a little different than that, in the sense that if a claimant files its timely notice and it jumps through the proper hoops, I guess the statute of limitations being just to put the defendant on notice that a potential claim exists. I don't see what prejudice is there, especially absent the clear interpretation of the language that says a claimant gets 6 months from the date of their receipt of a final determination.
Back up here. So what if a claimant under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act files his or her claim a year and a week after? Is it viable?
So I guess there's two issues. One, if you file your notice after a year, if you don't timely file your notice, right, you're barred. So if it goes over a year under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act, you're barred because you have to file notice within a year.
So then back to Justice Papik and Justice Funk's questions. So that individual really would not find him or herself in that after 18-month scenario. Is that right? Filing after 18 months. Wouldn't it be DOA?
I'm not sure I understand the
would
question.
Would the claim just be prohibited because it was filed too late under the State Tort Claims Act if you filed 18 months and a day?
I don't think so under the State Tort Claims Act. As my understanding is that if you under I believe it's Hollinger and Coleman that both seem to reach this issue under the State Tort Claims Act, not the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act. But you know, I'd be happy to write a supplemental brief on that. I didn't get too deep into the actual State Tort Claims Act case law.
Thank you.
I think I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kim, good morning to you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The plaintiff failed to file their lawsuit within 2 years as required under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act.
And what does Ragland say about that?
Well, Ragland, as well as 139191, says that there are but two exceptions to that, and that's the dispositive question on appeal, whether under the court's de novo review, the complaint has alleged sufficient facts to show that when it was filed, it was during a six-month extension period under 139191. And under the law as it has existed in this state for the past 37 years, the answer to that question is clearly no. The Ragland decision, as Justice Papik pointed out, tells us what must be done to trigger a six-month extension period to file and when it must be done. In terms of what must be done, either the governing body of the political subdivision issues final disposition of the claim, or the claimant withdraws the claim. In terms of when it must be done, which is the most important consideration in this appeal, that must be done with less than 6 months to go before the two-year statute of limitation expires. And that is consistent with the plain language of 139191. And that law has existed in the state for 37 years, has been unchanged to this point. And I would point the court to pages 10 through 13 of our brief on the discussion of Collins, in our Collins versus State. In our view, it would be unwise to adopt the reasoning of Collins here for several reasons. First of all, Collins versus State was a State Tort Claims Act case. This is not a State Tort Claims Act case. This is a Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act case. And although those acts are similar, they are different in a crucial respect. And that difference was hinted at and discussed during appellant's argument, which is the shorter period, the one-year period, as opposed to two under the State Tort Claims Act, to file your claim with the government. And the effect of that is that, unlike under the State Tort Claims Act, the political subdivision can never just wait out a claimant and prevent them from filing suit. Because as we know under 13906, also under the State Tort Claims Act, once you file it with the government has up to 6 months to consider it. And because there's an irreconcilable difference, an irreconcilable conflict between two provisions of the State Tort Claims Act that this court has addressed, starting with the Coleman case, the Hollinger case, the Collins case, Sharkey, and most recently Comar versus State this year, trying to make those two statutes, one which gives the state 6 months to consider a claim, while the other requires a claim to be filed with the state within 2 years, but also requires you to file suit within 2 years. So considered under the plain language, the State Tort Claims Act could be read to prevent a claimant from filing suit within the two-year statute of limitation. And that's why you have that line of cases. There is no similar line of cases under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act. Raglan has remained good law since it was issued in 1981. The Davis versus Town of Clintonia case applied it, cited it with approval. The Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act itself has not changed substantively since 1981. And that's why you have those different series of laws, line of cases. And under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act, worst case scenario, if I'm a claimant, I have to file within a year. I do so on the last possible day, 1 year after my claim accrued, after I'm injured. I have to wait 6 months while the political subdivision considers it. After 6 months, 13906 gives me the right to withdraw it. And at that point, I still have 6 months to do so and file suit timely within the two-year statute of limitations. But what Raglan tells us is that for that right to withdraw and file suit, I am obligated, which is the word that the court used in Raglan, I am obligated to take action, to withdraw the claim. Unfortunately, in this case, plaintiff did not do so. And what the face of the complaint shows is that claim accrued June 30th of 2015. That means the 2 year statute of limitation expired on July 3rd of 2017. Not until September 13th of 17 did MUD, at least according to the plaintiff, issue final disposition of the claim. So the 2 year statute had at that point expired for over 2 months. And for that reason, under Raglan, under 139191, that act by MUD did not trigger a 6 month filing extension period, consistent with the plain language of the statute.
What does that denial do? Does that denial have any impact?
In terms of the analysis of the timeliness and the analysis under 13919, no. I mean, the impact is to say your claim is time barred. You know, imagine if no action had been taken by the political subdivision for 10 years and a demand is made by the claimant to the political subdivision and the political subdivision's response, rightly, is, whoa, this claim is time barred and I'm sending notice of that. Well, under plaintiff's conception of the act, that would trigger a new 6-month period to file suit. That's an absurd result that is not warranted by the plain language of the statute, and it's unwise, in our view, as a matter of public policy, because the whole purpose of statute of limitations is to bring to an expeditious end the uncertainties of litigation, to prevent the stale presentation of stale claims.
Does your interpretation allow local governments to hope they can outwait the person who's filed a claim, and I will use this term, perhaps inappropriately, trick claimants into not being able to file in court after their claim has been denied?
No. The interpretation we are advocating is an interpretation that has stood the test of time for the last 37 years. And because of the way the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act is formulated, there is no possibility, first of all, for the political subdivision to wait out a claimant and prevent them from filing suit. That's 13906. They have the right to withdraw the claim after 6 months. And in terms of tricking a claimant, that would be a different analysis in our view, Judge. That would be more of an equitable estoppel argument, where maybe a course of conduct by the political subdivision lulled them into inaction. That's not our facts. What the face of the complaint alleges that the first action that MUD took was over two months after the statute of limitation had expired. So there's no allegation under the complaint of a continuing course of conduct that we somehow tricked the plaintiff
under
into inaction.
Under your suggested interpretation, why would any political subdivision ever make a disposition of a tort claim prior to the expiration of the statute of limitations?
Your Honor, perhaps a political subdivision would issue final disposition in order to reach a settlement with a plaintiff. That is a perfectly...
If they weren't going to settle the case.
If they weren't going to settle the case.
If they weren't going to settle the case, why would they ever do it before the expiration of the statute of limitations under your interpretation?
Well, I think there are other considerations that may be in play in terms of political subdivisions may have an interest in being, for lack of a better term, a good citizen and to be known to timely respond to claims. I understand the nature of your question is because of the possibility that the claim may be time barred, why would a political subdivision ever issue that final disposition?
Why did your client wait till after the expiration of the statute of limitation before replying?
Well, I can't speak to that, Your Honor. I don't know.
Is there anything in the record about that?
There is not. At this stage, there is not. There is not. The other thing to consider. See, I'm out of time. Appley respectfully requests that the court affirm the order of Judge Coffey dismissing the complaint. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute, 25 seconds.
1 minute and 25 seconds, Mr. Wasson.
Yes, Your Honor. So, very briefly, a couple things. I believe Comar set a bright line rule that says that a claimant is not obligated to withdraw unless they want to toll that or create that 6-month exception, and that's not the case here. Now, as far as a a case that exists in perpetuity that somehow the claimant has control over, that's not our position. Our position that everything that the claimant has to do has to be done within the statute of limitations. Our position is that once we file everything that we have to do and do everything that we have to do under the statute of limitations, then it's in the claimant's hands, or in the defendant's hands. And if the defendant decides that they don't ever want to file a disposition, as was in this case where the statute passed, then the claimant's out of luck, even though the plain language of the statute clearly affords 6 months. Now, I would also like to draw the court's attention to Davis v. Clatonia, because Davis v. Clatonia flirts around this exact same fact pattern under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act. And the only issue with that case was the denial letter that the claimant received, but that they were trying to invoke to grant to be given that exception, was received from the governing body's insurer and not the governing body. That was the only difference. And it seems like this court was...
So did it speak to the issues involved in this case?
It hinted around. The facts were very similar, but the only difference was... I see I'm out of time. The only difference was that the final disposition letter was sent from the governing body's insurer and not the governing body. Thus, they couldn't invoke the statute. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much.